So here's kind of the thesis statement I want to present to us. The place of suffering in our pursuit of joy. Kind of sounds strange, doesn't it? Putting those two things up together. Suffering and pursuit of joy. But we have to bring them both together. So here's the thesis. I don't know if you can see that. It's on your sheet if you want to look down there too. I think God uses our suffering and our self-denial to keep us from making a God out of pleasure and to help us find, that should be our deepest and most lasting pleasure in Him. So God uses suffering and self-denial in our lives to keep us from making a God out of pleasure and to help us find our deepest and most lasting pleasure in Him. In order for that definition to work biblically, we have to see a few things. And the first thing we have to see is that God uses our suffering to draw us into deeper and more lasting joy in Him. In order for that to work, God has to be in control of suffering. All right, if there's this whole domain of reality in our lives that God doesn't have control over, and a lot of people will argue that suffering is in that sphere, that suffering happens, God is doing everything in His power to prevent it, He's not able to prevent it, and then He tries to work around it as best He can. Right? That would not be the view that we're presenting here. We're saying that God uses, in His divine plan and purposes, He ordains, He uses our suffering and our self-denial to keep us from making a God out of pleasure and to help us and to guide us into finding deeper and more eternally satisfying pleasure in Him. So let's look at that first, the sovereignty of God over suffering. This is going to be just real surface level, because we've spent a lot of time on this as a church in the past year. We had, I submitted some articles to our Bargain Hunter writing about this. We had a sermon series, if you want to go on the website and dig into this a little bit more, called, what was it called? Broken Mosaic or something Mosaic. Anyway, if you go on the website and type in suffering, I preached them, I don't remember the title of it. But if you go on there and you can go on the lessons or sermons and you click on suffering, you listen to a more detailed exposition of this. But let me just go over a few so that we can see it. God has absolute control over every part of His universe, including our suffering. And if we're in Christ, if we're trusting in Him, if we're born again, if we're part of God's family, God promises us that everything works together for our good, including our suffering. So let me show you some places in the Bible where we are brought face to face with the sovereignty of God over suffering. Give you a few examples. In Joseph's life. Now, remember what happened to Joseph. And a lot of bad stuff happened to Joseph at the hands of his brothers. What are some of the things the brothers did to Joseph? How did the brothers sin and
They enslaved him.
Okay, they enslaved Joseph, or at least they sold him into slavery. They kept him hostage for a little while in a pit, right? What else did they do? What are some of the ways in which the brothers sinned against Joseph? Sold him into slavery.
They lied about him to their dad.
Told dad that he died. You know, not at their hands, by the way. Some other way.
They took his family away from him.
They stripped him of his family. Right? That cloak that was so precious to him because it was a symbol of his father's love for him. They stripped him of that. They took it from him. They hated him. Right? They, for all intents and purposes, they harbored anger and hatred and jealousy and bitterness over him, and then they tried to kill him, and then they couldn't do that, so what they ended up doing was just selling him into slavery. So it's a pretty tough go that Joseph had at the hands of his brothers. Now, look at what Joseph says toward the end of his life. God has raised Joseph up, brought him into Egypt, set him in a position of power and authority. God is now using him to save many people, and through the whole narrative, God is ultimately providing for the seed of Adam that would one day come if Joseph hadn't been there in Egypt perhaps Abraham and his extended family wouldn't have made it. So we see what God's doing, how he's overruling in these situations. But look at Joseph's commentary in the brothers, okay? As for you, this is Joseph speaking, the you is the brothers. You, now this word meant is important. You meant evil against me. Now there's another player in this, but God, he was also involved in it, meant it for good. Okay? The parallel in the original was crystal clear. The brothers were intending, the brothers were willing, the brothers were bringing about Joseph's sufferings with evil purposes and intentions, but God, at the very same time, was bringing about those same circumstances, willing the same events, but he was doing it with holy good intentions and purposes. And you can see where his was going, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Okay? God had absolute sovereign control over Joseph's sufferings. Let's look at Jesus' sufferings, right? Acts 4, in this city they were gathered together, the Apostle Peter's praying here. This is their prayer meeting, and here's the content of his prayer, part of it anyway. They were gathered in this city against your holy servant Jesus, those whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to kill the Lord Jesus Christ, to crucify him, to hate him, to whip him and beat him and curse him, and to do all that they could to destroy him. And that, according to verse 28, is whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. Not one of the actions at the crucifixion was outside of God's plan and hand. He had purposed all of it. And of course, we know the greater good that he was bringing about through that event, right? None of us would be in this room born again and forgiven had God not exercised sovereign control over the suffering of his beloved son, Jesus. All right, another example. Paul. Take Mary, one of those. Let's look at Paul's life, 2 Corinthians 12. Now you got to pay close attention to this one because you may be tempted to miss it if you don't pay close attention to how Paul talks about this. So Paul's talking about his experience, whether in the body or out of the body, doesn't know. It was a unique experience. He was shown a glimpse of the heavenly courts. And to keep him from being too elated by the surpassing greatness of the revelation, so that keep him from boasting, to make him humble, a thorn was given me in the flesh. Now that's suffering. Now we don't know exactly what the thorn was, but whatever it was, it involved suffering. We know that because three times Paul pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave him, that the Lord would take away the thorn. And what's God's response? But he said to me, no, not going to take it away. He says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, most people, when they see this passage, immediately jump to what Paul says in verse 7 and say, well, see, this isn't from God. This is a messenger of Satan. See that? To harass me. Right? So, who gave Paul the thorn? What do you see in that text that indicates the one who gave him the thorn? Who gave him the thorn? It was given to me, right? Who gave it to him? Was it Satan? Can't be Satan. Why not? Look at the purpose statement. Yeah. So Satan is doing the harassing, okay? Is Satan trying to keep Paul from being too elated? Is Satan attempting to cultivate humility in Paul's life? No. Who is? God is. and he has absolute control over Satan. Think about Job. God said, you can go this further and no further to Satan. God could have said, you have no right to touch his family. But God had a greater purpose. He loved Job more than that. And he was willing to use the harassing hatred of Satan in the life of his child to bless his child, to show grace. Okay? So that's Paul's life. We can look at other examples in Paul's life. But let's look at us for a second. 1 Peter 3:17. It is better for us to suffer for doing good. And then look at how Peter says it. If that should be God's will. Okay, in the context, he's telling, I believe it's servants, to be submissive even if their masters are wicked people. And he's saying, you know, you could suffer for doing evil, but what good is that? God would rather you suffer while you're doing good. Now, we don't always suffer when we do good, right? But sometimes we do. Sometimes we suffer injustice, and that's according to God's will, if we do. Okay, another example, Philippians 1:29. For it has been granted, okay? The word there is given as a gift, a gracious gift. Now, look at what Paul says. It has been given that for the sake of Christ, you should not only believe, so faith is a gift, but also, and here it is, to suffer for his sake, also given. And the word there, again, it's a gracious gift from God. So God has absolute sovereign control in all of our suffering. Okay? Old Testament, New Testament, whether they're a church leader or not, doesn't make any difference. God has absolute control over the suffering that we experience, and he uses it, as we've been saying, for our good. So, some, highlight some, because we could list a lot more than this. Some of God's purposes in our suffering. So he's got control over it. And the thesis is God uses our suffering and self-denial to keep us from making a God out of pleasure and to help us find our deepest and most lasting pleasure in him. So what are some of the purposes God has for suffering in our lives? Well, we're told that God uses suffering to refine and strengthen our faith. Okay, now I'm going to go through some of these verses. Just want you to keep your antenna up for the words joy and rejoice and so forth. We'll come back to it in more detail in a second. But just as we're going through this, just notice how pervasive it is in the Bible, okay? Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet. And we know that this isn't limited to persecutions. Some people argue that. It's any kind of suffering, trials of various kinds. So whether you have cancer or whether you have a financial loss, you've lost a job, perhaps you are experiencing persecution from someone. There's a variety of ways in which we suffer in this life. And God uses those various kinds of trials for the testing of your faith to produce steadfastness. And as steadfastness is cultivated, you become holier and holier, perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. See how God is using various trials in our life to strengthen and to refine our faith and make us steadfast. Sometimes he'll use suffering in our life to correct our waywardness, like a father would discipline his children. We're talking about that in our sermon series now. Hebrews 12, for the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, okay? God is more concerned about our holiness than he is about our comforts, according to this verse. Some of it seems painful, okay? But later, what does it do? It yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. He's training us through the painful experience of discipline, so that we would be righteous and holy people. And I think in many cases that involves corrective discipline. We're going the wrong way, and so he lovingly brings us back, like any parent would. to display in us the gospel of Christ. 2 Corinthians 4. But we have this treasure, he's referring to the gospel, in jars of clay. I think he's referring to our earthly bodies, or weak as they are. Just like jars of clay, you could just punch a hole through them. We have this, why? To show that the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We are afflicted in every way. We're not crushed. We're perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body, and here it is, the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our bodies. So in some way, as Paul is suffering for the sake of the gospel, he is putting on display a crucified and risen Savior for sinners like us. That's another purpose God has in our suffering. And maybe this is the biggest one for us and what we're talking about, to teach us the incomparable greatness of the age to come. So Paul's speaking about some of those sufferings that he mentioned, right? It's pretty intense suffering. Think about his life. Think about the time he went into a city to preach the gospel, and he was nearly stoned to death, drug out, left for dead. Right? That's suffering. Think about the torment Satan had in his life through whatever that thorn was. Think about the ways in which he was betrayed time and again in his life. Think about the hardships he dealt with. Think about the imprisonments, the weakness of his body. And here's how Paul comments on it. This slight, momentary affliction. Isn't that incredible how he describes that? Is doing what? Is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory. See, slight, momentary here, and eternal. Compare those two. Beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen, for the things that are seen are transient, the things that are unseen are eternal. So Paul views his suffering, as intense as it was, as but a slight, momentary affliction when compared to the everlasting, never-ending, all-satisfying weight of glory that is incomparably satisfying to what he's going through now. That's how he got through it. That's what he was looking forward to. And now we're beginning to kind of see where joy might be able to fit into this. How could Paul go through such terrible suffering and still have joy? Well, it's not because he wasn't suffering. We know he was suffering. It's not because the suffering wasn't painful. It's not because Christians are masochists and we get our kicks from suffering and pain. We're not delighting in pain per se. Because if you think about it, pain is not a good thing in and of itself. It's part of the fall. It's a result of sin. In many cases, the suffering that we experience is directly the result of someone else's sin. Injustice is a widespread form of suffering, especially throughout the world. So we're not to delight in the suffering itself per se. We're in pain for the sake of pain, but for what God is doing in and through our suffering to draw us closer to Him, to keep us from making a god out of the pleasures of this world, and to help us find our deepest and most enduring satisfaction, pleasure in Him. So let's look at some of the ways in which this plays out in the Bible. The ways Christians then, given this background here, very brief as it is, how we ought to respond to suffering and self-denial in the Christian life. Let's just start with Jesus. Okay, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5. Blessed are you when others revile you, suffering, and persecute you, that's suffering, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account, that's suffering. And look at what Jesus says. He says that you're blessed when that happens. I just pause for a second and think how antithetical that is to the so-called health and wealth gospel today. That if you're not experiencing an abundant life of blessing and ease and prosperity and health here and now, you must be doing something wrong. Jesus turns that right around and he says, you are blessed if you're suffering. That's why, verse 12, we ought to rejoice and be glad. Because we love to suffer? No. For your reward is great, not here, but where? In heaven. Okay? So what's the response of Christians? Rejoicing and gladness. All right, let's keep going. Jesus says in Mark 8, and in the parallels in the Gospels, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. So maybe as we've gone through this series, you've heard me talk about a relentless pursuit of joy in the Christian life. And maybe in the back of your mind are verses like this. Well, doesn't Jesus say, if we want to be first, we should be last? If we want to save our life, we have to give up our life. If we want to follow him, we have to deny ourselves, not glut ourselves in joy, whether it be in God or anything else. What about the denial here? Well, Jesus says we have to deny ourselves. But here's the joy in verse 35. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? Now, there's the reverse here, too. This profit happens for Christians as they forfeit the world, okay? As we forfeit the world, what do we profit? We profit life. When we lose our life, we end up saving our life. That's gain. That's profit. So even here, when Jesus talks about denial, there's still gain for us as Christians. You see? So I still think we're pursuing joy whenever we deny ourselves to follow Jesus. Whenever we take up our own cross, I think we're still pursuing joy. Okay? We'll look at a few more and then we'll wrap up. 1 Peter 1. In this you rejoice. There it is. Though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been grieved by various trials. Okay, so here's Peter. Peter talks a lot about suffering right at the outset of 1 Peter. He brings us face to face with rejoicing in various trials. So that, and again there's purpose, the tested genuineness of your faith, we saw that already, more precious than gold that perishes, though it's tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you don't now see him, you love him. And though you don't now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory. It's one of the most beautiful verses in the Bible on joy. And it's right here in the context of suffering. We ought to rejoice with joy that is inexpressible, even if God should will it, we're suffering. Again, 1 Peter 4. And this one's particularly helpful, I think, in what it tells us not to do. Do not be surprised. Many of us, when we experience suffering, think something strange is going on. Like, what have I done wrong? This is abnormal. And, Peter describes it as a fiery trial. Don't be surprised by it when it comes upon you. And again, here's the purpose, to test you. As though something strange were happening. This is not abnormal. Right? A father disciplines the child that he loves. To not experience that from the Lord makes us illegitimate sons, the author of the Hebrews says in chapter 12. So, don't be surprised by it. If you hit suffering this week of some kind, if you run into relational conflict, if you get a diagnosis in the next month, if you have any particular kind of suffering in your life, the first thing you shouldn't do is be surprised by it. Because when we're surprised by it, we get imbalanced. We begin to run, we begin to get angry, we begin to feel like we're not getting our what God owes us in some sense. But if we are expecting this life to be a life of self-denial, then we won't be surprised by it. Rather, so here's the negative, okay, here's the negative statement, and here's the positive statement, but rejoice insofar as you share in Christ's sufferings. That, okay, rejoice so that you might rejoice. It's like piling up joy here, okay? Rejoice that you may also rejoice and be glad when His glory is revealed. And just hint, by the way, what are we rejoicing in? We're rejoicing not in our circumstances, not in ourselves. We're rejoicing in His glory. Okay, what's the little couplet that's kind of summarized the essence of Christian hedonism? Who remembers it? God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. Our joy, our rejoicing upon rejoicing upon rejoicing, our joy inexpressible is in Him and His glory, which makes much of Him. That's how we glorify God. So hopefully you're beginning to see some of this tie together now as we're walking through this. We maybe have a couple more here. Romans 5, we rejoice in our sufferings. Romans 8, we consider that the sufferings of this present time, are not worth comparing with the glory that's to be revealed to us, echoing what Paul said in 2 Corinthians. Hebrews 11, and here we'll end it here. But just take a second and try to think how our pursuit of joy in God trumps our pursuit of joy in the things of the world. Because that's where we're going with this. To trump our pursuit of joy in the things of the world is going to entail denial. It's going to entail suffering. And look at the example of Moses. When he had grown up, he refused to be called Pharaoh's daughter. He had an upbringing of prestige. Okay, and prominence and privilege and so on. He willingly chose, rather to be mistreated with the people of God. Moses willingly chose self-denial and suffering, rather to enjoy, and this is, set this to memory, the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ. And here it is. He's denying himself. He's suffering. And all of that, for Moses, was gain. Greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt. See that? For Moses, he could endure mistreatment and reproach and denial and hardships. Read his life. Look at what he went through. He could endure those things because he was fixing his eyes on an eternal weight of glory, like Paul says elsewhere. He was comparing the present sufferings and the denials and the trials and the hardships. He was comparing that with what awaited him. And it just wasn't worth comparing. And just maybe a little illustration of this and how we do this a lot of times. A lot of times if we are looking forward to a delicious dinner, we won't eat a heavy lunch. All right? And maybe we want that heavy lunch. We're hungry, right? But we forego it, maybe feeling a little bit of the hunger pains there because you're eagerly expecting this delicious dinner that's upcoming here, just a few hours. It's coming quick. Won't be a big thing to forego that to get that dinner that's coming. If we can do that for a meal, and you can think of it in a lot of other ways, right? How much more should we compare 80 years maybe, 70 years, however long we live, to eternity of joy that is not even worth comparing to what the world has to offer us here now? So that's how I think these things relate. That's how Christian hedonists, people who want to bring God the most glory by finding our deepest and most enduring satisfaction in Him, that's how we think about and approach suffering in this life. If you had one verse to sum it up, it'd probably be from 2 Corinthians 6. Sorrowful, yet always rejoicing. That's a Christian hedonist view of suffering. I have a quote here from David Livingstone, but I think I'll just forgo that and stop for questions. I know that's a lot to take in, but you can maybe go back and look at the verses. We'll come back next week. We'll talk about how to fight for joy in the Christian life.